All right, we're starting here on the bottom of Lamed Daled Amud Bet by the two dots. Ze Omer Shalavutai, Ze Omer Shalavutai. Each one of them says that the property belonged to their forefathers. Neither of them has any evidence to that fact. They don't have a dim, they don't have a chazaka. So they're both making the same claim, and they both have the same lack of evidence. So what do we do with these two individuals? Amar Rav Nachman called the Olim Gavar. Whoever is stronger wins in this situation. So Gemara is going to ask, how is this different than other cases we've seen throughout Shas, where we don't have that solution of Kol Da'alim Gavar? But before we start that, what is exactly does it mean, Kol Da'alim Gavar, whoever stronger wins over here? Kol Da'alim Gavar is that, as the Rashbam says here, either through strong arming it, through force or physical force, or berayot, or through proofs that he is able to show that he is more rightfully the owner or deserving of this property. The Rashbam, later on today's daf, explains the process of Kol Da'alim Gavar is basically an abdication by the court to not get involved with the situation. Because if the court gets involved in the situation and arbitrates this situation, it's going to end up in a bad result for the court, because almost inevitably they're going to have to change their mind or change the outcome of the case. As he says over here, he says, in this case of a hocha b'haikarka, the leka lo shtar v'lo edim, this land over here has no edim, no shtar. V'ikol ha'mekam ala demilta im yavoh v'yayidu. There is a possibility that other edim will come along afterwards and give us evidence or give us more information. Hilkach enkan lomar chaluka v'shuda. There's no reason to use these other mechanisms for arbitrating, because shema yavoh edim v'satru at the din. Maybe people will come along and undermine whatever the conclusion of Beitin is. Shudanu Beitin, hilkach ein Beitin nizkakim lahem. Ladun din, shesofa lavo lidei ivut. Why would Beitin interfere or get involved in a situation in which in the end it's going to get upended or it's going to be the wrong answer? There's no upside here for Beitin to be involved in the process. Elimin ichim otan. We just leave these people. B'chol dalim gavar. Achivo edim vivaru adabar. So the way that the Rashbam views it is, it's basically a way for Beit Din to step away from the situation and say, you guys work it out. It's between you. We have nothing to add over here. We can't do anything that's going to be beneficial to the parties. We have no more evidence from either of the two parties here that's going to help us adjudicate this case. If we come in and decide the case, in all likelihood it's going to get amended, because someone else is going to show up with evidence, and then we're going to look silly that we interfered in the case when there was evidence to the contrary. So Beit Din says, we have no upside here, we're out of the picture, you guys work it out between you. That's the view that the Rashbam takes in terms of what does it mean, Kol Da'alim Gavar. Kol Da'alim Gavar means it's between you, the court steps away from it. On the other hand, the Rosh over here has a slightly different formulation of Kol Da'alim Gavar, where it seems that the Rosh feels that it's a little more of a process, or that we're going to come to an outcome that is beneficial when we use Kol Da'alim Gavar. And that is what he says over here in the Rosh. It's in the Perek Gimel Ot Chavet 22. He says, Hai Kol Da'alim Gavar Dinohu. So he says straight out, Kol Da'alim Gavar is a conclusion. It's a din. T'chom Misha Gavar Yado B'pam Rishona Hu Shelo. Whoever wins the first time, whoever puts it in their possession the first time, it's his. Achi avi chaviro raya. Until his friend brings some contrary proof. V'chozman shelo yavo raya. As long as he doesn't bring any contrary proof. Afim tigber yado. Even if he is able to overcome the other party. Lo shavkinen le la fuke mine. We don't allow him to pull it out of his hands. Delo mistaber shiktkunu chachamim shiuko yamehem biriva. How could it be the Chachamim institute something that's going to result in fighting for years to come? Umachloket ayom yigaber ze umachar chavero. Today this guy will overcome, next day the other guy will overcome. El Chachamim pasku. It's a psak halacha kol da'alim b'pam hazot. Whoever gets the first one, who gets the upper hand the first time, gavar, he wins. V'samchu al ze dechomisha dinimo karov la'vi rayot. Person who usually is right, usually brings the rayot. Va'od, Misha Dinimo, imsor nafsho, lamid shelo biyado. He will make extreme efforts to get back which belongs to him. Imash imsor acher ligzol. Rather than with the other person, the efforts he'll make to steal from the party. Va'od yomar, ma betza shimsor nafshi. Why should I go out of my way to invest so much in this? Va'yomo machar yavi rayav yotzenu yadi. And I'll end up losing it in the end. So for here, the Rosh says a number of things which differentiated from what the Rashbam says. The first thing he said is, dinohu. This is a real conclusion. This is not an abdication by the court, but rather a decision. The court, exactly, it seems like a psak halacha, according to the Rosh over here. Number one. Number two is, the Rosh sees this as being a solution to the problem, because of two reasons. One reason is, if we let them fight forever, then we've done nothing to help out the situation. So what we will do is, whoever gets it first, whoever takes control of the property first, we will defend his rights then going forward. So whoever is hold Alim Gavar, Beit Din then will keep it in his possession unless there's evidence to the contrary. He basically becomes the muhzak in the property based on that. And now Beit Din will interfere on his behalf and not let you take it out. It's an amazing statement, because why should Beit Din get involved at all? Why should it defend the rights of this person who overcame the other party and not just walk away or step away because they don't know? What you're saying is correct, which is the Rosh believes that there is a greater goal over here, which is to bring peace to the situation, to establish a stable way to manage this situation. And therefore, yes, we'll let Kol Da'alim Gavar. Kol Da'alim Gavar means both through power and rayot, and through proofs that that person will take possession of it. And then, given that he's taken possession of it, we will defend his right to keep it, only to keep the peace, because that's part of Beit Din's role, is to keep the peace between parties. The second thing the Rosh says is that it most likely will end up with the right party. And that is because, number one, the person who has the rightful ownership of this property eventually will get his rayot, and pretty soon, he seems to indicate. And number two is, he says something along the lines of Shlomo HaMelech, when he has to deal with the baby that belongs to the woman, he says, oh, we'll cut it in half. The woman who it really belongs to is Moser Nafsha to say, I don't want the baby cut in half. The other woman who's just trying to take the baby has less connection to the baby, and therefore will not be as connected or be Moser Nafsha for the baby. And he sees through that who is the real mother of the baby. And similarly over here, that's what the Rosh says. The one who works harder at this is probably the real owner. For two reasons. First of all, someone who owns it will do anything to get back their own property. And number two is, the Gazlan is not going to invest so much because he knows it could be taken away from him in the end. So he sees Kol Da'alim Gavar not only as a mechanism for bringing peace, but also it's a technique that says that we probably will get to the real owner by using Kol Da'alim Gavar. It's a very interesting approach of the Rosh over here. Other Achronim, like the Chatam Sofer and others, take that and then try to superimpose it on the previous Gemara. The Gemara that we ended with yesterday, about when something comes into the hands of Beit Din, whether Mafkinan or Lo Mafkinan, do we interfere, do we not interfere? And if we do interfere, do we then give the property back? He wanted to suggest the Machloket revolved around this Rosh and the Rashbam. It depends what you feel called the Olim Gavar is. If you feel that Kol Da'alim Gavar is an abdication of the court, then once the court has taken possession of the property, for them to abdicate any role in there is unfair and not the role of the court. The court has already now got the property. They can't just throw it out there and say, do what you want. On the other hand, if you believe that this is a psak din, then you can understand why they would disgorge the property from the court and say, you guys work it out. Because that is a mechanism of deciding the case, not simply an abdication of the court. And therefore, yesterday we had the machlok between Rav Papa and Rav Yehuda as to whether mafkinan or lo mafkinan. Rav Papa says mafkinan because he holds like the Rosh, that this is a psak din. Therefore, when Beit Din has the property, he can disgorge it and tell him, Kol Da'alim Gavar. The other hand, Rav Yehuda says, like the Rashbam, that Kol Da'alim Gavar is an abdication of the court's role. So once the court's taken possession of the property, they can't just throw it out there and say, Kol Da'alim Gavar. That's not a court process that they're putting it through. Then they are now responsible to see it through to its end. Kol Da'alim Gavar is not seeing it through to its end. It's simply walking away from the situation. So that's how the Chatam Sofer, other Achronim, try to take this machloket between the Rosh and the Rashbam and impose it on the previous Gemara that we saw. The problem with that is a little bit that the Rosh in a tshuva seems to walk back his position and seems to indicate somewhat otherwise, that this isn't exactly a psak din, it's more like along the lines of the Rashbam. And so the Rosh in his tshuva seems to almost contradict that which he says here, which seems to indicate it's a psak din. In the tshuva, he seems to say more along the lines of the Rashbam, that it's a court tossing it out to the other parties. But what you have to say is that maybe there's some balance between those two, which is that if the court is already engaged and involved in the situation, then we want the court here to bring some conclusion to this case. And therefore, Kol Dalim Gavar maybe in of itself is not a conclusion, but it gives us a mechanism for keeping the peace afterwards. And so therefore, once somebody wins, we will defend their rights, even though technically, why should one party have any more rights than the other party? But there's a greater goal, or there's a greater idea behind keeping the peace than there is in allowing the right parties or the parties just to fight it out. And therefore, the court interferes in some sense, not because it knows the solution, not because it knows the outcome of the situation, but rather simply because it has other roles. Its role is not simply to give a psak din, its role is also to maintain the peace. And in that sense, Kol Dalim Gavar is a mechanism for keeping the peace. It may not be a psak din, like the Rosh says over here. Maybe it's like the Rashbam says, it's an abdication of the court. But even in that abdication of the court, they might still want to be involved to ensure that the resolution is a peaceful resolution. And therefore, once somebody wins or somebody gets the upper hand, the court will go and then seal that as the conclusion. So even though it's not a psak din, they will enter the fray in order to preserve the peace once the two of them work it out. But in that way, then, the machloket between the Rosh and the Rashbam is not so significant in terms of the fact that Beit Din is abdicating over here. It's simply a machloket about once they've abdicated, what happens. According to the Rashbam, it stays that way and court doesn't get involved at all. The Rosh says even after they've abdicated, the court would then interfere only to maintain the peace once that has happened. Again, that's because of what the Rosh says in the Tshuva, but the Rosh here in the Gemara seems to be saying that this is a psak din that Rav Nachman is entering over here about Kol Dalim Gavar. The Balei Tosafot actually quote from the Rabbeinu Chananel in yesterday's daf, in the Balei Tosafot notes something about Kol Dalim Gavar. He says that a din Kol Dalim Gavar, the case with the boat where they were arguing yesterday, the conclusion is Kol Dalim Gavar. It says, Vim Tomar Mishna Mishnaim Ochzim Betalit. Why is that any different than the first Mishnah in Bava Metzia? We have two people holding on to the Talit, and the conclusion is Yachloku, that they split it. How come there we don't say Kol Dalim Gavar? So he says over here, Do Achazim is shiny. If they're actually holding on to the garment, it's different. The Kevin de Shnehem Muchzakim. Since both of them are in possession of the property, we will not permit one party to steal from the other party. As if we are now allowing the gazlan to come in here, wrongly grab it away from the other party, and to steal it from that other party. And therefore, we won't allow kol da'olim gavar versus cases where neither party is in control of the object. So here the Rabbeinu Chananel qualifies this idea of Kol Dalim Gavar. It's got to be a situation in which the parties are not engaged with whatever item it is. Therefore, when Beit Din abdicates or walks away from it, the parties solve the problem. What Beit Din can't do is walk away when the two parties are already engaged in the item. Because then there's a requirement for adjudication al yidei the Beit Din. You see from this Rabbeinu Tam something along the lines of what we just suggested in the Rosh, which is that Beit Din serves another role besides simply adjudicating. It also has an obligation to ensure that people are not wronged and that there's some sort of peaceful resolution to the problem. So in a situation in which there's nobody there, then let them work it out or figure it out. Once somebody already takes control of the object, Beit Din will enter the fray in order to preserve the peace at that point. So in the case of Shnayim Ochzim B'Talit, Beit Din enters the fray because they already are in possession. Somebody, they're holding it. We got to come to a resolution to solve the problem between these parties. We're not let one party steal from the other party. We're not going to let them fight about this forever. We have to do something. So there we enter the fray. In this case, where there's nobody mukzak in the property, Beit Din says, let them deal with it. As soon as someone becomes mukzak in the property, Beit Din will enter the fray and say, no longer are you allowed to take it away. The other party has no longer has a right to call Dalim Gavar. We have to stop it somewhere and say that somebody's taking possession. Once they've taken possession, you don't have a right to take it back. This is more evidence of the fact that even if you want to suggest that Kol Dalim Gavar is that Beit Din walks away, Beit Din's only allowed to walk away in situations where there isn't a muhzak in the property, there isn't some possibility that the other person is stealing, or there's going to be an ongoing problem that persists. And that's what the Rabbeinu Tam seems to be saying over here, the difference between Shnayim Ochzim versus our case, or the case of the boat before. And again, if you superimpose that on the Rosh, this idea of coming to peaceful resolutions might be a charge of the court, irrespective of whether they can come to the right din or the right conclusion in these cases. If there's nobody who's mukzak, the court can stop and walk away. But as soon as someone becomes mukzak in the property, the court must enter the fray in order to stop this continuous process of them taking it from each other, both because we don't want gezel to take place, but also more importantly, we don't want this continuous fighting to go on. We must come to a resolution that will bring peace between the parties. That's Rav Nachman's position over here. Gemara says, Umayishna. How is this different than other cases we see in Shas? Mishnei shtarot yotzim beyom echad. You have two contracts that come out with the same date on them. An individual passed away, gifted property to two parties. The only problem is that both shtarot are dated on the exact same day. The Rav Amar Yochloku. Rav says that the conclusion of that case is you split it. Shmuel Amar Shuda de Daini. It is the option of the Dayanim as to what the conclusion should be. Over here, in a case where you have two contracts that are dated on the same day, even if we know what time of day that they were contracted on, and we have a time stamp on them, that won't help the situation, because the Gemara we saw in Ketubot differentiates between inside of Yerushalayim and outside of Yerushalayim. And that is, in Yerushalayim, they were makpid on writing the hour or time of day that it happened. Therefore, in Yerushalayim, we assume that if the time is written in it, so one was in the morning, one was in the afternoon, the one in the morning will govern because that is the first contract. On the other hand, outside of the Yerushalayim, the Gemara says they were not makpid al shaot. They were not careful about the time of day, and therefore the time of day is not relevant. As long as it's dated on the same day, each one of them has the same rights, and we have no idea which contract was given first. So now you're in a situation in which we don't know the conclusion to this situation. And what is the psak halacha? You have Rav and Shmuel arguing about what to do. Neither of them say like Rav Nachman, Kol Da'alim Gavar. Nobody says let them work it out between them. Both of them have some sort of solution. Rav says Yachloku, split it between them. They both have equal evidence over here, so split it between them. Shmuel, on the other hand, says Shod Dedaine, which we'll explain in 1 second what that means, but the basic idea is we want to grant it to one party. So how the Beit Din goes about doing that is a machloka between Rashi and Balei Tosafot all over Shas. Over here, the Rashbam takes up the position of his grandfather, Rashi, and once again, his younger brother, the Rabbeinu Tam, argues on him, as well as on his grandfather, Rashi, as to what Shuddah D'Daini is. Rashi says that Shuddah D'Daini is that you, whoever has better proofs. The Beit Din looks at the situation, and looks at the circumstances, and tries to assess between these two parties, who was the gifter more likely to gift to, and then they come to a conclusion, and they say, this is the better outcome. It should go to this person or that person, because it would be more appropriate, or seems like this would have been the intent of the other party. That's what Rashi and the Rishbam say is Shuddah D'Daini. The other, the Balei Tosafot say, Shuddah D'Daini means, whatever you want to do. The Dayanim get to decide, willy-nilly, they can roll dice, they can flip a coin, they can do whatever they want, they just got to get it to one of the two parties. That's what Shuddah D'Daini means. It's simply left up to Dayanim to decide who they want to give it to. Tosfot over here speculates about why don't then the Dayanim put up an auction and see who pays them more to give it to them. So he says that maybe that would be problematic because that would negate their standing as a Dayan, because any Dayan who takes money is not considered to be a Dayan anymore. But he speculates that maybe that should be the way to solve the problem, because whoever pays them, they will give it to. But the Tosfot believes that there's a randomness to the giving of this, of Shuddah D'Daini, and he proves it from other places in Shas where Shuddah D'Daini is used, and over there, there's no reason to believe that one party has it over the other party. Actually, one of the examples is our Gemara right here. The Gemara over here is suggesting that Zeh Omer Shel Avotai V'Zeh Shel Avotai, Rav Nachman says, Kol Da'alim Gavar, Gemara says, why don't you think of it like the Shtarot? And the Shtarot, what's the solution of that Shtarot? Rav says, Yachloku, Shmuel says, Shuddah D'Daini. Over here, Shuddah D'Daini, what does Shuddah D'Daini have to do with either party here? Each one of them says it belongs to my father. Why would you give it to one party over the other? Why should it belong to one party or the other? Neither one has more evidence than the other party. So there's no reason to believe it belongs to one over the other. In a gift, you can understand why you would go to Shuddah D'Daini according to Rashi and say, oh, he's more deserving, or he was closer to this individual. It makes sense that he gifted it to him. Over here, Zeh Omer Shel Avotai, Zeh Omer Shel Avotai, why would the Dayanim even think that they know better as to who the property belongs to? So for that reason, Balei Tosafot argue on Rashi and say Shuddah D'Daini is this random distribution. There is an additional view of Shuddah D'Daini in the Gaonim, which says that it is really a pshara. It really is some sort of arbitration or compromise that's brought between the parties. The Baal Yad Tosafot actually quotes from the Rabbeinu Chananel that he had a Mesorah that there is only Shuda Dedaina Bekarkaot. Shuda Dedaina only has application by land, but not by Metaltalin. And number two is that only a Dayan Mumche is allowed to do Shuda Dedaina. Tosafot rejects this and proves that it's not true, that Shuda Dedaina applies even by Metaltalin, not just by Karkaot. Although he does not necessarily upend the idea that you need a mumche, you need a dayan mumche, in order to have shuda d'dayna, you can't just have lay people or arbitrators do a shuda d'dayna. Now the difference between Rav and Shmuel is, Rav says you have a safek over here, whenever you have a safek, yachloku, you split it. Shmuel's idea is that if you split it, then you're wrong 100% of the time. Each party got 50% of it, but you know you're wrong for sure. With Shuda Dedaina, you have a 50% of a shot to being 100% right. Which is that, if you give it to the right party, you got it right. If you give it to the wrong party, you got it wrong. But there is this binary outcome, which is that you might actually get it to the right party. And if you do get it to the right party, they've got 100% of what belongs to them. By Rav's solution of Yochloko, you will never get it to the right party. Because by definition, you've only given 50% to each party. So you'll be 50% right and 50% wrong, but you'll never be 100% right. Shmuel's solution gets you a possibility of being 100% right 50% of the time. So that's the difference in a view of what to do in these situations. What the Gemara wants to know is why in that case do we come to a different conclusion, either Yechloko or Shuda Dedaina. And over here in our case, we're saying, Kol De'olim Govar. So Gemara says, Hotam Lekam Demekam Ala Demilta. Hocha Ika Demekam Ala Demilta. This is where we saw the Rashbam before. There's a big difference between the cases. In the case of the shtarot, there's no more evidence that's going to come that's going to upend the case. The safek as it exists today will persist forever to be a safek. They have the evidence. The most evidence you can have is a shtar. And that's all in front of us right now. There is no other evidence that's really going to come out that's going to change the conclusion. That's not absolutely true. We could have edim that come and say this is mizuyaf. We could have other evidence that comes along. But in all likelihood, the best evidence is sitting in front of us, and there really is a problem. There's a problem, which is that there are two shtarot that are sitting here that are both signed on the same date, and there's no way for the dayanim to conclude which shtar was given first. Assuming that both shtarot are mikuyam, both shtarot are good shtarot, then it's going to be impossible for the dayanim to ever come to a conclusion about this case, because even if we find out one was in the morning, one was in the afternoon, it won't change the din. There's nothing that would change the din at this point. Therefore, bringing a conclusion of Yachloku or Shuda Dedaina makes sense. Although the Rabbeinu Yonah does believe if we got Edim, that would indicate us that the Mesira happened first for one of the two contracts, or that Sha'ot would make a difference, unlike what the Rashbam says over here, that we would believe them. Nevertheless, we have the Edim who are documented in the contracts, and we can go speak to them. And despite the fact that we've spoken to them and we've already tried to clarify the information, we still haven't come to a conclusion. At that point, we can assume that there's very little other evidence that's going to come to the forefront that would change the outcome of the case. Because all the people involved in the case, we already know, and we're able to interrogate them, subpoena them, and get the information. Despite that information, we're unable to get a conclusion. That really is indicative of the fact that very unlikely to be any more information that comes to the forefront. Unlike the case of Zeomer Shalabutai, the Zeomer Shalabutai, whereby we have no evidence. We have no idea who we're going to speak to. And therefore, there's very likely more evidence that's going to come to the forefront after the conclusion of this case. In our case, and this is where the Rashbam says his opinion, over here, we just have a complete lack of evidence. Each one of them is making a claim without any evidence to their claim. There could be evidence brought afterwards that will sway the case. And that's exactly what the Rashbam says. We don't want the court involved in cases where further evidence is going to upend their conclusion to the case. Why should they get involved and make a decision only to have it overturned by evidence that's going to come? Let's wait for the evidence and we'll decide once the evidence comes there. In between, let them fight it out between them. Once we get the evidence, then we'll make a decision. Without evidence, we're not going to make a decision. Again, the Rosh says we're going to make an interim decision and then try to deal with it, and that is the Kol De'olim Govar. But in either way, the difference of mechanism that we want to use has to do with the nature of the safek. In the case where the Beit Din can't do any more, then the Beit Din will try to bring a conclusion to the case. In the case where Beit Din can do more, once evidence surfaces or once more information is brought to the forefront, then they were going to leave it, called Dalim Gavar, and then they will only intercede where they feel they can make a difference. That's once the evidence shows up. There, since the conclusions will change, or there will be new outcomes to this situation, Beitim will get involved at that point. In the interim, we say, Kol Da'olim Gavar. There's a little bit of a, there's another issue or background machloket that's going on with regards to Rav and Shmuel, and that has to do with the fact that how a shtar becomes a shtar. You remember we had that machloket in the Gemara in Ketubot and Gitin, as to whether Edei Chatima Karte, the signatory is to the contract or more making an effective contract, or Edei Mesira Karte. It's machloket Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir means Edei Chatima Karte. On the other hand, Rabbi Elazar says Edei Mesira Karte. So over here, that is in the background of this machloket, but here between Rav and Shmuel as well, because if they are dated on the same day, for Rabbi Meir, it's very straightforward. If they're dated on the same day and they were signed on the same day, it's clear that they went effective on the same day, because whenever they were signed and dated, that's when they went effective. On the other hand, for Rabbi Elazar, who says Edei Mesira Karte, just because they're signed and dated on any given day doesn't necessarily mean that the contracts were given on that day. That's when they went effective. So you could actually have it backwards. You could actually have the contract that is signed earlier be given later. And that means it was effective later, even though it was dated earlier, if you say Edei Mesira Karte. So here, the Baalei Tosafot make two comments about that. The first of which is, we assume that when a contract is signed and dated, that the Mesira happened very close to that, or happened almost immediately. We're not assuming that there's some sort of gap between them. The second thing he says is, even if the Mesira happens later, it is effective retroactively, which means that once the contract is given, and the Edei Mesira are Karte, they're the ones who make the contract effective, that effectiveness is retroactive to the date in the contract. So that's very important. Even according to Rabbi Elazar, who says Edei Mesira Karte, the date in the contract makes a difference. So therefore, since these two contracts are dated the same day, even if the Mesira happened at a later time, that Mesira won't change the fact that the effectiveness of the contract, once it is effective, goes back to the date on the contract. So then that means that both of them, again, become effective on the same day. So that's actually an important piece of background to this. Then he goes on to explain that the machloket here between Rav and Shmuel relies on this machloket between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Elazar. And the Baalei Tosafot would say over here, the time of the Rav, Rav's reason is, Mishum Tosavar Ke Rabbi Meir, Damar Edei Chatima Karte, V'chein Yechloku, Afile Ike Edei Mesira, Shenimsa Lachad Kodem, Kevin Shemetoch HaChatima, Enikar Mi Kodem. Since through the signatories, there's no way to know which one came first, therefore by definition, you have to be Yechloku, because there's no evidence that could come here. Even if Edei Mesira come later and tell us one was given before the other, it's not going to make a difference for Rabbi Meir. And therefore he believes that, not Shud the Dainer, but rather Yachloku. And he says, obviously, this is a case, Ma'ir b'matanau mecher, shekone b'shtar. It's obviously a case where the acquisition happened through the shtar. You can acquire a property through a shtar, kesef or chazakah. If it's kesef or chazakah, then the shtar doesn't make a difference because the shtar is just proof of when it happened. Then you really need to know when the transaction happened. Over here, where the transaction happened through the shtar was the vehicle for acquiring the property, that's when you have this type of outcome, because over there, according to this, whenever it was signed, will make the difference. And since within the shtar, there's no way to determine what happened based on the dating and the signatories to the shtar, that doesn't matter if you bring evidence afterwards that it was signed earlier or signed later. For Rabbi Meir, that doesn't matter. Rabbi Meir says the effectiveness of the shtar has to do with the information in the shtar and the signatories to the shtar. And therefore, if I can't determine from inside the shtar what time it was or when it happened, I can't bring any more evidence. There's nothing to discuss anymore. And we're locked in. And that's why Rav over here believes, like Rabbi Meir, that you split it because there's no other information that can be brought here that would alter the case. It's a safek that will remain a safek in that manner. And he says over here, Shmuel damar shudah d'dayni haynuk Rabbi Elazar. Damar edei mesira karte. Dila Rabbi Meir lo avamar shudah. According to Rabbi Meir, you would never say shudah d'dayni. If you view that the case, that Rav holds like Rabbi Meir, and Shmuel holds like Rabbi Elazar, then Tosfot says that the Gemara's question here is only from Shmuel. Because, according to that, Rav's din has nothing to do with our case. Rav's din is a problem in the fact that the signatories to the contract are at a fixed time period. Whereas, according to Shmuel, it says, Shudah D'dayni means the Dayanim pick who it goes to. Over there, there's a reason to believe that that's a different solution to the Kol D'olim Gavar. Rav's solution over here is a halachic solution to a problem that remains a safek. Shmuel's solution of Shuddah D'Dayne basically is, we're in a stalemate, we're in a problem, this is the way we deal with it, give it to the Dayanim to decide. So when do you say Shuddah D'Dayne, and when do you say Kol D'Alim Gavar? And that's the question that the Gemara is bringing according to this. Tosfos goes on to point out that there's another lashon of the machloket there, where Rav also holds like Rabbi Lazar, the Edi Mesira Karte, and the machloket between Rav and Shmuel is simply what's a better solution to the problem, like I explained before. Is it better to be 50% right by both and 50% wrong? Or is it better to be 100% right 50% of the time? And if that's the case, then Rav and Shmuel are both offering solutions in a situation where the court can't decide. If that's true, then both of them are questioning on Rav Nachman, who offers a third alternative. And the question is, why are these alternatives used here versus the alternative of Kol D'Alim Gavar? The Gemara's answer is the cases are different. Case by us is a case which has solution or could have evidence brought in the future. The case by the Shtarot is a case where there's no more evidence that's going to change the outcome of the case. Now, the Gemara asks from another case that we are also familiar with. It's brought up numerous times in Shas from the Mishnah in Baba Kama, which is Omai Shlomiha. From the Mishnah of Baba Kama that says, it's not a machlip para bechamor ve'yalda. Person who has a kinyan chalipim between a para and a chamor. Again, this has to be a kinyan chalipim in order that nobody is there when this happens. The person purchased a para by exchanging it for a donkey. So once the person makes a kinyan on the donkey, automatically the para goes into the possession of the other party. In that way, they could be with the donkey and not with the cow at the time that the cow gives birth. So the cow gives birth, the yalda, and we have no idea who it belongs to because nobody was present. Did it happen before he made the kinyan on the chamor or after he made the kinyan on the chamor? V'chein, ha-mocher shifchato v'yalda. Someone who sells his maidservant to this individual and she gives birth. Did she give birth before she was sold or give birth after she was sold? Over there, it could be through kesef because a shifcha knanit has a din like karka and you can acquire it through kesef. If you acquire through kesef, it could be that you're not present when the shifcha gives birth. So both of these scenarios are kinyanim that will allow it to happen even though you're not present. Kinyan chalipin is I take possession of the chamor, automatically the para goes into your possession so that nobody's there to see what happened. The shifcha knanit can be purchased through cash, and since you can be purchased through cash and have a kinyan, he pays the cash, nobody's there when she gives birth. We have no idea if it happened before or after the transaction took place. Ze omer, ad shelo bacharti yalda. The seller says, it happened before I sold it, they gave birth, whether it's the shifcha or the cow. Ze omer, mishalakachti yalda. The other one says, after I bought it, I purchased it, then she gave birth, the cow gave birth. Yachloku, they split it. So again here, you have a different type of solution to a problem that a court can't solve. Over there we say, yachloku. How come over here we say Kol D'Alim Gavar and not Yachloku or the other way around? Why don't we use Kol D'Alim Gavar over there by the case of the Shifcha and the Para? So in this case, it's different than the case of Shtei Sharot, because over here there might be additional evidence that could be brought to the forefront that would help us to adjudicate the case. So you can't argue over here it's different than the case of Zemo Shabbatai, Zemo Shabbatai, which the Gemara previously made a distinction between whether additional evidence will help us or not. Shtei Sharot, we said no additional evidence will help us because the information that we have is all in front of us right now, versus the case of Zer Mer Shabbatai, where additional evidence would help us. In the case in Baba Kama, additional evidence would help us. If we have someone who witnessed the birth and knows exactly when the transaction happened, maybe that additional evidence could clarify the situation for us. And if that's the case, then we could adjudicate the case. So this is a question of Nachman, because over here, despite the fact that additional evidence would help us, we're still saying Yachloku. So here, it's interesting that there's no Shuddah D'Dayne. Over here, we don't see Shmuel offering the option of Shuddah D'Dayne. We only offer the option of Yachloku. And that is because, as the Rashbam says over here, V'Shuddah D'Dayne Lekele Amar Me'ahachi. Over here, it's not relevant to say Shuddah D'Dayne. Afilu Shmuel, de lo shayich lemeimar, le gabi matana l'shnayim. Shiyu beitin lemi ohev yoter, de l'dei gamaru makne. So the Rashbam following the pshat of Rashi in Shuddah D'Dayne is a situation in which the Dayanim say, who would have he favored in this situation? That makes sense when you're talking about a gift. So then you could say, he would have gifted it to this person or that person. In our case, the Shuddah D'Dayne doesn't make sense because why should you give it to one party over the other party? There's no reason to believe that one party deserves it over the other party. That works well according to Rashi's explanation. According to the Rabbeinu Tam's explanation, that Shudda Dadani means the Dayanim just get to decide whoever it goes to. Why isn't Shudda Dadani relevant over here? How come Shmuel does not have his position upheld over here? He says, Yachloku. All right, so Amotzi Mechamero Labaraya, the Gemara in Baba Kama already discusses and says it's the para or the shifka were found in a possession or a place that neither of them owns. The para was out in the agam, the shifka wasn't in their property, because you're right. If it was in one of the two parties' properties and they gave birth, then there would be a mukzak in the item, and therefore it would be a motzi mechamero labaraya. In order to take that out of the picture, you have to say that it was found in a property that belonged to neither of them, and therefore there's no mukzak in the property. Given that there's no mukzak in the property, therefore the determination is yachloku. We know actually the Mishnah in Baba Kama is following the position of Sumchus, which is that the machloki between the Chachamim and Sumchus as to whether Motzi Michavere Olav Araya governs, or whether Yachloku, when you have Mamona Mutaba Safek, you split it. Sumchus's view is that you split it. So over here you have Mstam Mishnah in Baba Kama that seems to be like Sumchus. So what the Baha'i Tosafot say over here, don't prove from here that the Locha is like Sumchus. Because he says, the adkan lo pligi alei hotam b'shuel mishum dazlin and batar chazaka de mamona umekina becheskat marakama halavachi modu de yachloku. The chachamim agree with Sumchus where there is no mukzak that yachloku, and that's what we just explained, that there is no mukzak over here. Given that there's no mukzak over here, therefore even the chachamim will agree that yachloku, that the outcome in this case is to split it like Sumchus. So either if you explain the case in Baba Kama as being a case where it's in a location that is not mukhzak le'echad mehem, and therefore even the chachamim agree yachloku, certainly in our case over here, neither party is mukhzak in the property, and therefore the outcome should have been yachloku. And even though Tosafot points out there a number of times in Shas where the Gemara seems to indicate like Sumchus, nevertheless, the loch is not like Sumchus, and we paskin like the chachamim, that amotzi mi'chaveiro alav haraya. The Rashbam does say there was a girsa or an explanation that this Gemara is actually a question on Shmuel, not a question of Nachman. How come by para we say yachloku and we don't say shudda d'dayne? Using that, you could then explain, according to the Baalei Tosafot, that even Shmuel agrees in this case that you come to the conclusion of yachloku and not shudda d'dayne because of the drora de mamona. And for that reason, Shmuel will agree to Rav's position that yachloku over here. And Baalei Tosafot go on to show that both Shmuel and Rav Nachman paskin like the Chachamim neged Sumchus, and therefore Halacha is like the Chachamim that emotzi mechaveiro olav haraya. All right, so now the Gemara says Hatam over there lahai itlei drora d'mamona or lahau itlei drora d'mamona. Over there we have a drora d'mamona. That is the same thing that the Gemara says in other places, that there is a difference between drora d'mamona and when there is no drora de mamona. So over here, hacha, idemar, lo demar. Idemar, lo demar. In our case, it's very clear, zeomer shel abutai, vzeomer shel abutai, it's very clear in that case that one party owns it, and one party does not own it. One party who owns it definitely owns it, the other party is precluded from owning it. If the second party owns it, then the first party doesn't own it. There is no drora de mamona in our case. Whereas in the case by the Mishnah in Baba Kama, there is a drora de mamona. So the Rashbam explains over here, the drora de mamona is that both parties have a rightful claim to ownership. One before the Kinyan and one after the Kinyan. But we know for certain that both parties owned it, and both parties owned it at a certain period of time. Whereas in our case of Zeromer Shalabutai, Zeromer Shalabutai, neither party has evidence of the fact that they ever owned it. We don't even know if these two parties are the rightful owners of the property. It may be that neither of them owned it. Drora d'mamona is also a machloki between Rashi and Tosafot on Bet Amud Bet in Baba Metzia. That is, drora d'mamona according to Rashi is there is hefseid mamon. There's a loss of money over here. A party is going to lose out in this case. If you take it and give it to the wrong party, someone is going to lose money. That's what Rashi calls drora de mamona, that if we come to a conclusion or a solution over here, someone's going to lose money. On the other hand, the Baalei Tosafot believe drora de mamona is a safek that exists independent of the court case. The court case is not what generated the safek. The safek pre-existed the court case. So it's actually much easier to understand the position of the Baalei Tosafot over here, which is In the case of the para and the chamor, the safek exists whether they come to court and declare their positions or whether they don't declare their positions. We have no idea when that para gave birth. Did it give birth before the transaction or after the transaction? Did the shifka give birth before or after the transaction? That safek exists even if they don't come to court and declare their positions. On the other hand, with regards to the land or the property that we have over here, before they show up in court, there is no safek about the property because nobody's declared ownership or said that it's theirs. It's only because they came to court and said, this belongs to me. And the other guy said, no, it belongs to me. That's what generated the safek. The safek is not an inherent safek in the property. It's a safek that is caused by the claims of the two parties. But the only reason we're dealing with this, the only reason there is a safek here, is that the safek was brought to the forefront because of their claims. Without their claims, we wouldn't have anything to discuss about this land. On the other hand, with the case of the birth of the para and the birth of the shivcha, there that safek is a safek in reality. It has nothing to do with the court case itself. It has to simply do with the fact that we have a problem. We're asking the court to intervene and try to figure it out. But even if neither of them came to court, they'd still have the same problem between them, which is when did it give birth? We have no idea when it gave birth. So that's what the Tosafot calls Derarah de Mamona. Derarah de Mamona is that there's a pre-existing safek. It has nothing to do with the court case itself. So in that case, you say Yachloku. In our situation, it's a fabricated safek because it's the claims that generate the safek. Over there, we'll say, kol dolim gabar. On the other hand, the way that the Rashbam and the Rashi read it, that there is some sort of tisaron, or there's some sort of problem over here that pre-exists, then you have to suggest over here that the difference between the cases is that in the case of the para, somebody definitely owns it. Since somebody definitely owns it, if you give it to one party over the other, you could cause a loss in the situation. In our situation, it's not clear that either party owns it. They're both making a claim, but we're not even certain that either party owns it. So that means there's a possibility that your adjudicating the case will actually result in nobody losing it because there is no real owner over here. Neither of these parties are the real owner over here. So that's how you have to explain it according to the Rashbam, that the safek leads to a chasaron mamon in the case of Baba Kama. In our case here, it doesn't necessarily or doesn't absolutely lead to a loss of money, because it's very possible that just like they're arguing with each other, there neither of them really has a right over here, and therefore you're not guaranteed that you're going to get to a loss position over here. And because of that, we say that there's a difference between the cases. For that reason, our case from Nachman concludes is called Olim Gobar. Two shtarot, we say, is either Yachloku or Shuda de Daine. Whereas, by the case of Baba Kama, we say Dror de Mamona, that Beit Din as Yachloku, because otherwise we're going to end up with a situation in which you're allowing losses to come about. Or you're allowing a safek that the parties cannot deal with to be solved in a way that's not just. Because you're allowing them to fight it out, you may as well split it. So then, Amrei Naradai, Im ba'echad min ha'shuk, ve'echzik ba, ein motzin oto miyodo. If someone comes and then steals this property, we're not going to take it away from him. So that even though this person has no claim, and he just comes up, shows up and takes the property, we're not going to take it out of his hand. Detani Rabbi Chiya. So this is the Naradai, or taking a statement of Rabbi Chiya and applying it here and think that this is the place to apply it. Gazlan Sharabim, Lav Shmei Gazlan. Someone who steals from the public at large is not called a Gazlan. So what the Naradai are saying is, this is what Rabbi Chiya meant. He meant when you steal from people who we don't know who it belongs to, Beit Din will not intervene because you're not called a Gazlan in that case. You're not called a thief when you steal from people who don't have any evidence to the fact that they own this property. In addition, if Beit Din comes and forces you to disgorge the property, they don't even know what to do with it at this point. They're going to force you to disgorge the property and then say, kol dalam gavar, there is no return of the gezel over here because you can't return the gezel. So over here, the Beit Din is not going to cause you to disgorge the property because you're considered to be a gazlan min arabim. And he says, gazlan min arabim, well, you don't know the true owner. That's not called gezel. It's a very difficult position of the Naradai over here. But they're clearly reading this statement of Rabbi Chiya is applying to our case. That when you steal from the public, you're not called a thief. And the Ritvo explains this idea that the Naradai, the Mekamri Echad Min Hashuk Nira Shein Lo Ba Shum Raya, Fili Ochi Kasavri, Kevin Shgam Echad Mehem Ein Bo Raya, Reu Kazuche Min Hefker. It's the equivalent of him taking it from Hefker because neither party can bring evidence to the fact that it's theirs. So therefore it becomes as if this property is Hefker and he's not classified as a Gazlan. Or, The way that the Rashba explains it is that he can say, then neither party can come and make a claim over here, because he can always argue, you're not the claimant, you're not the real owner here or party to my case. And therefore you have no claim of gezel against me, because you can't prove you are the true owner of this property. Vashi amar, the olam shmei gazlan. No. You steal from the public, you are a gazlan. Umay lo shmei gazlan. What does it mean he's not called a gazlan? Shnol nitan lishavon. The problem is you can't return it in this case. You're unable to do beishivit akzela asher gazal. It's not that you're not a gazlan. You are a gazlan. But you can't rectify the fact that you are a gazlan. Normally a gazlan has a way to rectify the situation by paying back the person that he stole from. Over here, you have no ability to do that. Okay, very good. So why not in this case? So over here, we have in other places in Shas, the Gemara talks about it's a machloket tanaim. If a person steals from one of five people, and then the five people show up and all five of them say, you stole from me. So there's a machloket tanaim between Rabbi Kiva and another Tana as to whether you just drop the property in between them and say, you guys figure it out. Or you have to give the property back to all five people. You have to pay all five of them back. So there Rabbi Kiva says, Ein ze yotzei de shamayim. If you want to really be yotzei de shamayim, you want to give the gezel back, you give it to all five parties. And then you're sure that you gave it back to the rightful owner. The other party says, just drop it in between them and they have to figure it out. You gave it back, you disgorged it, but the other party didn't get it. We discussed there that the chakira might be as to what the obligation of returning gezel is. Is the obligation of returning gezel to disgorge it from yourself? Or is the obligation to ensure that it gets back to the original owner? So therefore, you could rectify the problem over here by simply either disgorging it and putting it in the hands of the court to decide who it belongs to, or you could simply give it back to both parties. You could do Meshivat Akzela Asher Gazal. So the Rashbam says that the problem here is you can't return it to the rightful owner, and therefore you can't do Meshivat Akzela Asher Gazal. Because Mechaper Bashava, Deinu Yodela Mi Yashiv, he doesn't know who to give it back to. Mechashibad Yadot, Zerich Lashiv the Balin. V'lo Letziya Mitachi Yadol Afkira L'Shnayim Arishonim. Not just make it hefker and let them work it out, the Kol Dalim Gavar, that's not called returning the Geza. Now, there are those that argue that he simply can return it to both of them and he could solve the problem, so then why is that an issue over here? They then say the problem there is the fact that neither of them really own this property. We have no idea who really does own the property, and it may be one of these two, maybe neither of them, and therefore he's unable to accomplish Veshivat Gzela Asher Gazal. On the other hand, the Ramban and the Baal Tosafot brings the explanation. Theft here is a theft from the Rabbim, and Rav Ashi's statement over here has nothing to do with the case of Zeh Omer Shalabutai, Zeh Omer Shalabutai, but rather it's coming to explain Rav Chiya's position without it relating to our Gemara at all. He's just simply explaining what is Rav Chiya's position, and it relates nothing to our Gemara at all. The Nardai thought Rav Chiya's statement related to our case. Rav Ashi comes along and says it has nothing to do with our case. Has to do with a case where someone is stealing from the public at large. They stole from the public and now they have no way to return it to the public. For instance, a person has a scale that is got the wrong weights in it. He puts false weights or fake weights in it. And therefore anybody who came into a store to buy was subject to the theft that he had these light weights in there, and therefore they were buying less than they thought, and he's been stealing from people for years. By the time he's finished, at this point, there's no way for him to return the object to the public because he's stolen from too many people. He's stolen from the public at large, not because it's public property, but he's stealing from the public because there's so many individuals that they become the public at this point in time. Meaning that there are two ways to become a rabbin. One way is because it's property owned by the rabbin, by the public at large. Or you can be public, or you can be a public or rabbin because there's so many individuals and now you consist of a rabbin. And there's two ways to have something become a rabbin. In the end, you're stealing from individuals who comprise the rabbin over here. And he has no way or mechanism for returning it to the individuals. So the Gemara over there suggests that the solution to the problem is that he should do some public works. He should do something for the public at large in order to rectify it. He should take the money and fix the road. And therefore, anybody who was cheated will use the road and get that benefit back. So the Baal Tosafot note over here, despite that fact, I love Hashava Ma'al Yotohi. That is not a real return. It's a nice way to do some tshuva, to disgorge the theft and to try to rectify the situation. But in the end, that's not a real return of the property of the people you stole. Because in the end, you can never make that calculation or determination as to who you stole from. Based on that, Rav Ashi says that's where Rabbi Chiya is applicable. Rabbi Chiya has nothing to do with our case. The Nardai say Rabbi Chiya is relevant to our case over here. Rav Ashi comes along and says that's not true at all. You, first of all, you're called a gazlan when you steal, even though you don't know who the owner is. And number two is, when you steal, you have to return it. And since you can't return it, then you remain a thief, or you're unable to disgorge and get rid of the theft because you can't get it back to its rightful owner. And that's the problem. It's not our case over here. In our case, you probably could get it back to the rightful owner. Either you disgorge it and let them work it out, or you give it to the court. But in a case where you stole from many people and you have no way of rectifying the situation, that's called stealing from the Rabbim. So Rav Ashi says it has nothing to do with our case at all. Now, Tosafot over here says something that's incredible, and it's very difficult to understand. Tosafot says, why can't the two parties over here, according to the Naradai, who say that there's a third party comes in and steals it, then they can't go to court and extract it from him. Says, why can't the two parties who were arguing beforehand be koteva harsha'a? Harsha'a is basically you give a power of attorney to the other party. Since the problem is that you have no real claimant over here, according to the Naradai, when this person stole from the people arguing about the property, we can't force him to disgorge it because we don't have a claimant. Because if he comes in and says it's my property, he'll say it belongs to the other guy. The other guy comes in and say it belongs to the other guy. So there's no real claimant in the case. So Tosafot says, why don't they create a harsha'a between them? Which basically says that one of them gives power of attorney to the other, and then a single individual can represent both parties. Since he can represent both parties now, then they could be a claimant, and they could extract it from this individual. Now you have a single claimant coming to this individual. So Baal Tosafot says something unbelievable. Vafilu kazvu arsha'a zelazeh. Even if the two parties arguing about this property write arsha'a to each other, holo virishaim heim enis kakim lam. Since they are both rishaim, we do not deal with them. Why are they Rishayim? Tosafot over here says they're Rishayim. Why should they be Rishayim? One of them is justified. One of them is the rightful owner. The other one is not the rightful owner. You could argue that the answer is that maybe neither of them are the rightful owner. And they are considered Rishayim over here because they're both trying to take property that doesn't belong to them. But that's a big assumption. That assumes that you know that both of them are trying to steal the property. But what happens if one of them is the rightful owner of the property? Why is he considered to be a Rasha, according to the Baalei HaTosafot? Baalei HaTosafot say, no Rasha over here. We're not going to do this because a Harsha'a is a creation for, or an invention of the Chachamim to help people out in situations. We're only going to invoke that principle or the use of a Harsha'a when it is for people who are deserving of that benefit. If they are not deserving of that benefit, then we're not going to help them out. That's what the Baalei HaTosafot are basically saying, which is that you have two Rishayim over here. We're not going to allow this institution, the Chachamim, Harsha'a, to function to help them out because these people aren't deserving of that help. So it's very possible that this is Mishnah Avot, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Chet. Yehuda ben Tabai v'Shimon Shetach kiblu mehem. Yehuda ben Tabai omer al tas atzmecha korchei hadayanim. Kshiyu balei dinim omdim lefanecha, iyu beinecha kirishayim. When you have two parties that are standing before you arguing a case, you should look at both of them like Rishayim. And once you adjudicate and decide the case, when they leave, you should view them both as being Zakayim. Once they accept the psak of the Beit Din. So you see here a Mishnah Avot that says when two parties come to court to argue, they are both considered to be Rishayim. And only once you've adjudicated the case and they accept the outcome of the Beit Din, they're considered to be Zakayin, innocent or Tzadikim. Now, what you would say about this Mishnah, and the simple reading of the Mishnah is what the Tosafot Yom Tov says. Ukishneyem be'inav kirishayim. If they both look like Rishayim in your eyes, yichapes b'tanoteyem shekol echad. He will look into the matter carefully. Ubrahma'ut shekol echad. B'shvil kach yirad amitat adin. This will cause you to get to the bottom of the matter, because you look at both of them as being guilty. You're not favoring one party. You look at both of them as being questionable parties in front of you, and therefore you dig into the material of both parties. So it's just a way or a framework or a mindset of the Dayan in order to get to the bottom of things. Not that they're both Rishayim, but simply that if you consider them both Rishayim, then you'll delve into the matter and you'll consider or be suspect of any evidence that they bring. But that still doesn't mean they're real Rishayim. You assume that they're both wrong until proven right. But that still doesn't make them into Rishayim. That's just a mindset, framework. Why over here does Tosafot call them Rishayim? Then the Tosafot Yom Tov gives a second answer. He says, Gam Yesh Lomar, One of these two parties here is wrong. One of them shouldn't be in court here. One of them is either lying, or one of them is either trying to steal. And since you are a counterparty to this party, you get painted with the same brush as the other party. The Gemara says in Shvuot, we'll get to there in Lamedtet, Li'en Shvua. When it comes to someone taking a shvua, omdim shamarmim zlezes suranam al olei anishim arishayim aelu. It says, go away from these bad people. If you precipitate someone taking a shvuat sheker or a shvuat shav, you are equally held responsible as the person who takes the shvuat sheker. Because you caused the shvuat sheker. Now, you're right, you brought him to court and the guy lied. So why are you held responsible? Because you created a situation in which he had to take a shvuat sheker. You didn't lock up the situation. You didn't contract it properly. You didn't set it up with a deem so that we wouldn't end up in court with a shvuah. You become a party to the shvuat sheker when he takes the shvuat sheker, even though you're not the one taking it, even though you're the one telling the truth. The Gemara says that the other party is partially responsible for what happens over here because you brought him to a shvuat sheker. We see culpability. Chose kevin sheish l'deh din imo. Shnehem nikru rishayim ad shikablu et adin. Here, the Tosafot Yom Tov says, literally, we call both parties rishayim because you ended up in court. The fact that you're in court is already partially your responsibility. Even though you're right, and you're coming to court because you are right, but the other party only ended up in court or got a hold of this because you did something wrong. You didn't set up the circumstances properly, or you let something happen that precipitated a safek or a possibility that someone else ends up in court. And therefore, both parties carry a certain amount of responsibility with regards to that which happens in court. And then you could argue, literally, what the Baalei Tosafot say over here, that Shnehem Rishayim, that they both are considered to be Rishayim over here because of the nature of court cases. If you both end up in court and argue that it belongs to you or belongs to him, the fact that you have no evidence to your position allows the other party to come in. And therefore, you are a party to this other Rasha that's there. So that's a way to explain it that would indicate that the parties are considered literally Rishayim in the case when they approach the din, until they accept the Psak HaBeitin. Once they accept the Psak HaBeitin, they're both considered to be Zakayin. But when you're engaged in the din, you're considered to be a Rasha because you are in court and you're dealing with the situation, or you brought yourself to this situation. What is clear here, and the Rashbam points this out, by Tosfot point this out, is that if you bring a deem that your forefathers were there for even one day, then you're done. It's your property. Threshold for evidence here is very low. All you have to show is that one of your ancestors was there for a single day, and you're a Yoresh, we will automatically be Tawain on your behalf, and the property will go into your possession. So it's very easy for you to bring evidence to the fact that it's your property, because the other side has no evidence to show that it left your family. So as soon as you bring evidence that one person in your family is there for a single day, you're done. The case is closed. The fact that you can't bring that piece of evidence already brings suspicion to why you're in court about this property. Again, the fact that they're in court about this property is very suspicious, and a possibility that they both don't own it. There is a possibility of that, and we could entertain that. So the fact that you're in court about this issue already makes us suspicious of the fact that you're both Rishayim. And again, precipitating a case or a court case means that no pieces of evidence ever came up, and these seem to be spurious claims by both parties. And that's why we call them both Rishayim in this case, even though maybe one of them is right, maybe one of them is justified. The fact that we're in court about this case already means that a lot of things happened that there's no evidence over here. We can adjudicate it quickly to say, I have a deem that it was my forefathers, and we're not really in court. You can prove right away that it belonged to you, and there's nothing to talk about anymore. The fact that the court has to adjudicate the case, that's really, I think, where you would call them Rishayim. Anyway, so it's a very interesting Baalei Tosafot, but might dovetail with this Tosafot Yom Tov on the Mishnah and Avot, this idea that parties are called Rishayim when they're together in court. All right, now the Gemara says, Cheskatan Shlosh Shanim Yom Liyom. It's going back to our Mishnah. It says a chazaka is 3 years from day to day. I'm Rabbi Abba. I dalile ihu gufei tzina de peri the altar avi chazaka. If the supposed original owner of the property loads a basket of fruits onto the back of the supposed buyer of the property, he gets a chazaka right away. Because if you're the true owner of the property, why would you be helping the other party to take fruits out of your property? It's very clear that you should have made your objection immediately. The fact that you didn't make your objection immediately is almost an implicit acquiescence to the other party's ownership of the property. If you're the owner, you're not helping the other party to walk off with fruits from your property. He says, therefore, there's a chazaka immediately. Amar Rav Zvid, Rav Zvid says, v'im ta'an ve'amar l'peirot o'rativ. If he says that I gave him a right to eat the peirot, I sold him the peirot on the property, Naaman, he is believed in that case. So there is a way to get out of the problem of establishing a chazaka over here, which is that there are two ways to establish a chazaka. You're there for 3 years without any objection. Nobody says anything and you're working there for 3 years and you say, I bought it. That's one way to establish a chazaka. Another way to establish a chazaka, which would be immediate, is to say, I bought the property and I have witnesses to the fact that the previous owner of the property was loading me up with fruits and letting me walk off the property with the fruits. So that would should be the most obvious evidence of the fact that he doesn't own the property anymore. The answer to that is Rav Zvid says, if he says, not that I'm after the property over here, but I gave him the right to eat the fruits. He was an aris. He was a sharecropper on the property. And I was loading him up with his percentage of the fruits from the property. Then that's not evidence of a chazaka anymore because he's making a claim that says that it wasn't yours because I gave you the fruits. And that's why I was loading up with the fruits, because they did rightfully belong to you, but I never sold you the property. So that's a way to undermine that claim. The Baal Yom Tosafot asks, why doesn't the case have a migo then? In Rabbi Abba's case, where he comes along and he claims the property is mine, the other guy says, I bought it from you and I have evidence that you were loading fruits on my back. Why don't we say migo, that he could have said that I sold it to you for the fruits and not for the property, that he should be believed that it's his property. So the Baal Yom Tosafot say over here, like they did before, that's not a fair claim, because, so the Tosafot says over here, Yesh Lamar Davi Migo B'Makom Eidim. First of all, it's a Migo B'Makom Eidim. Then on Saturday, came into Dali Leit Sina the Peri Modosh HaPero Chelo. First of all, he's admitting that the Peri belonged to the other party by saying that he loaded them up the Peri. Vote. His claim is much bigger. In the claim that he's making, he wants the land back and the fruits back. If he say oratim the peirot, he'll only get the land back, not the peirot. So that's a weaker claim. And that's what the Ramban says in a more articulate way. Amigo is only amigo when your claim is better. The alternative claim would have been a better claim. Over here, his alternative claim would only got him the karka, not the peirot. His primary claim is to get the karka and the peirot. That's a weaker claim. We don't say amigo. For that reason, you don't have amigo when you made the claim for the karka. So in the case where you make a claim for the karka and you loaded him up with peirot, you lose the land because you should have objected. The fact that you're helping him shows that you are not the primary owner anymore. Now, if he originally comes in with a claim and says, I was loading you because you were an aris, that is a fair claim. But, hani milay b'toch shalosh. That's only if he makes the claim within the first 3 years. Aval la'acha shalosh, after 3 years, lo, he can't make that claim. Because, say, after Shalosh, even if you're not loading his back with the fruits, in that case, he gets to keep the property because now he has a claim, which is I bought it, and he has 3 years, and therefore, he is entitled to the property. So in order to make this claim that you gave it to him as an aris, you have to make that claim within the first 3 years, and you have to make that claim as your original claim. Not that the property is yours, but rather that you let him be an aris, and that's why you were loading him with the peirot. So I'm like, Rav Ashi, Rav Kana, the peireach, they, mevad. What happens if a person really sells property to an individual for a number of years to get the peirot? Whether that's he makes him into an aris for a number of years, or he does mashkanta de surah. And mashkanta de surah, which is an institution of the chachamim, by which you give as collateral the property over 10 years, the person gets to eat the fruits, at the end of the 10 years, the property comes back to you. At this point in time, the individual could just take the shtar mashkanta, hide it, and then he'll be entitled to take the property. You're going to lose your property. So how do you deal with a situation like that? What Rav Ashi is asking, according to the Baal Yom Tosafot, is not that he's arguing fundamentally on this, and he thinks that you can never make a claim like this, but rather he's asking practically, how do we deal with situations like this where you've given the person permission to eat the fruits of the property? He should have objected. Because if you don't say that, this mashkanta the surah that the language written is, Mishlam Shnaya Yilain, at the end of this period of time, that property will return to the original owner without any money. If the creditor just takes that shtar and hides it or rips it up, Mashkanta gabe, the mashkon is with him. V'amar lekucha, he'll be yadi. He'll just say, I bought it. And now he's had 3 years on the property, no problem, uncontested. And the debtor's going to lose his property. Hachanami de mehemin. You're going to say that he's believed in that case? Metakne rabbonim mide de'atibe de'deb seida? The rabbonim are going to institute a concept called mashkanta de surah, which was a way for them to pay back the loans by defeasance of eating off the land without it being called rebeat, because he's taking the risk in any given year that he might get fruits or might not get fruits. So even though if the fruits in a given year are double what the guy owes him, nevertheless, he's deducting an equal amount each year, and it could be zero that he makes from the property, it could be double, but that's not called rebeat because he's taking underlying risk. But if that's the case, the debtor is always going to lose. And the chachamim are going to institute something by which the debtor will lose because the other guy is going to keep his property. He has to make an objection. Basically, you have to go in the first 3 years in a mashkanta de surah, and also in a case where you allow an aris to come into your property. Within the first 3 years, you have to take aside a deem and say, this is my property. This is a mashkanta de surah. Or you have to get a document that's signed by the other party that shows that you are the true owner of the property. You must establish ownership within the 3 years. If you don't establish that ownership up front, you've caused yourself the loss. You are your own worst enemy in that case because you've allowed him to establish a chazak on the property. And now once he makes a claim, you're going to have no refutation of the claim. So your way to stop that up front is to make a macha, to make an objection and make a clear objection, either in court or to edim, and to ensure that the property remains yours even over a long duration when another party has rights to use the property or work on the property. And aris sold it to him for the production of the field. He was leasing it and getting the production of the field, or mashkanta de surah. In all those cases, you have to make a declaration because the contract is sitting with the other party, with the creditor or the other party. If he then goes and rips up the contract or hides the contract, he's going to have a claim to take away the property. And therefore, you either need a copy of the contract or you need evidence of the fact that you were mocheh during that first 3 year period. Rabbeinu Chananel explains that the case here with regards to the fruits is a case in which the supposed buyer of the property brings a basket of fruits as a gift to the original owner of the property. And that, the Rabbeinu Chananel says, is evidence of the fact that the original owner must not own the property anymore because he's accepting a gift of fruits from someone who supposedly stole the property according to his claim. And his acceptance of that gift is an indication of the fact that he must be okay or must be comfortable with the fact that this other person is presenting him with the fruit. Although the Rashbam over here says, Veina nira veinai. He doesn't think that's definitive proof because he could just be taking the fruit because he wants his fruit back and it's his only way to access it right now. Amar Rav Yehuda Amarav. Yisrael ba machmat akum, harehu kakum. Yisrael, a Jew who comes with a claim through a non-Jew, he has the same benefits as the non-Jew. Which means, ma'akum ein lo chazaka. Just like an akum has no ability to establish a chazaka, ela b'shtar, his only evidence to owning property is a shtar. Af Yisrael ba machmat akum ein lo chazaka ela b'shtar. So to a Jew that comes through an akum, he also only has the ability to establish ownership over the property through a shtar. Which basically means that if a non-Jew buys property, he doesn't have this institution of chazal that after 3 years, he doesn't need to show his shtar. The institution of the chachamim is after 3 years with no objection, then we assume that the person owns the property and nobody objected, therefore he doesn't keep the shtar and he lets it go bad or he forgets about it, lets it go loose. So therefore we give him the rights to the property. What the chachamim are saying over here is that when a non-Jew buys the property from a Jew, you have a serious issue, which is the Rashbam notes over here, the stam akum gazlanim, that in their day, they faced a big problem, which is that when the akum came and bought it, many times they were stealing it from the other Jew. And the Jew is too scared to object to his taking of the property. Therefore, the chachamim did not establish this precedent of chasaga that says if you have it for 3 years, you've established ownership, you don't have to show a shtar. That means that an akum will always have to show evidence of ownership through a shtar. A chazaka won't help him.
The Rabbeinu Gershom explains over here that the reason behind why the goy does not have a chazaka is because b'dinehem, there is no concept of chazaka. Which he says over here, the fish b'dinehem ein chazaka b'shanim. So therefore, since in their law there is no din of chazaka, we treat him the same way he would be treated under his system of law. And therefore, he doesn't have a din of chazaka.
The dinim b'chazaka is, in a sense, a benefit or a social contract between parties that agree that after 3 years, we will allow you to keep the property without a shtar. That only works for someone who's a party to that agreement. So the akum, wherein his dinim doesn't believe that that is a mechanism for gaining the rights to the property, then we're not going to give him that right when he comes into our system of law. But what is interesting about that is, if the akum establishes his ownership over the property in a non-Jewish court system, is that effective enough for then the Jew to buy it from him, and then we would consider it to be good? The Ritva does bring that if you have a civil society in which the court systems are trustworthy, if they establish the akum's right to the property, then a Jew who buys it from him can rely on that court decision in order to buy the property, and it will be upheld in a Jewish court as well. Although there are those that disagree and say that if we come into a Jewish court, we'd reopen the case to use the Jewish law to adjudicate the case and not assume that Dina de Machuta Dina governs in this situation. Therefore, a Jew who buys from this non-Jew is under that same burden of proof. He can't now establish a chazakah on the property, because his shtar only says that I bought it from the akum. But the akum can't establish ownership unless he shows a shtar. So therefore, you are only as good as the person that you bought the property from. And so the akum who bought it from a Jew must show a shtar. That means that Jew that now goes buys from that akum can't establish ownership through a chazakah, because his shtar, even if he shows it, says I bought it from the akum. Well, how do you establish that the akum had it? The only way to establish that is that if he had a shtar. So you're no stronger than the person that you came from. So Amar Rava, Vi Amar Li Yisrael, Didi Amar Li Akum, Diminach Zavna Mehemen. So Rava says something very strange over here, which the Gemara is going to reject because it doesn't make sense. Rava says, if the person who bought it from the Akum says, Lidi Amar Li Akum, the non-Jew told me, Diminach Zavna, that he bought it from you. Mehemen, he's believed. So over here he's saying, listen, if he bought it from the Akum, and he says that the Akum owned it, and now I bought it, he has no rights, according to Rava. But if he says the following, I bought it from the Akum, and the Akum told me he bought it from you, okay, we believe him now. Mar says, Mi'ika mide, dilu Akum amar lo mehemen. In a case that the Akum showed up in court and said, I owned it, we wouldn't believe him. Vilu amar yisrael mishmeid Akum mehemen. Now all of a sudden the Jew says, the non-Jew told me he bought it from you, also now he's believed. Why should that enhance his believability? Ela amar Rava, this is the emendation of Rava that makes sense. If the Jew says, I was there when the non-Jew bought it from you, and then he sold it to me, mehemen, he is believed. Because he could give a better claim. He could just simply say, you sold it to me directly. Here that the individual has already been on the property for shnei chazakah, he's already been on the property for 3 years, and he now goes to make a claim. He can make one of two claims. He can either say, I bought it from this non-Jew, and I was there when the non-Jew bought it from you. If he says that, we say he has a very good claim, and he has a chazakah, he can stay on the property. Because his alternative would have been to say, I purchased it directly from you, and now I've been there shnei chazakah, and the party would have no argument against him. He could say, I purchased it directly from you, and I've been there 3 years, and it's mine. Since he has a migo, where he could have, he wanted to lie, had a better lie, just to say, I bought it directly from you. Now when he tells us that he bought it from the Akum, and he was present when the Akum bought it from the Yisrael, we will believe him. He is believed in that case, and therefore he can establish a chazaka on the property. Okay, we're going to stop here. 7 lines down on the top of Lamed Vav, Amud Aleph.